Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Every year we get to do a special episode of Cutting the Curd featuring one of our all-time favorite guests, Jason Hines, sales director at Neal's Yard Dairy, co-founder of both the Essex Street Cheese Company and the founder of Borough Cheese Company, and British cheese expert and a good friend of mine. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Great.
As you are always here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man. It's nice to see you too. Every time that you're here, I learn something new, and that's one of the best things about doing the show for me, and it's a selfish thing, but I get to learn, and, you know, you ask the right questions, you get the right answers, you know what I mean?
We aim to please.
So, hello to everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Greg Blaze. Today we're talking to Jason about how to effectively sell cheese and what he thinks matters when curating cheeses for a counter. So let's start with selling cheese. Jason, what's the number one thing a cheesemonger should keep in mind each day when he or she sells cheese?
I think you have to break down cheesemongering into two things, the work and the tasks.
Okay.
So what do I mean by that? Well, for me, there are many things that occupy our day when we're mongering cheese. You know, things like, are there enough people on the schedule? Will they show up on time?
No, I know.
I know that's a topical thing for you today. there are also things like cleaning tasks and all those kinds of duties. And these are all very important and very necessary to run an effective cheese shop. But for me, the most important thing is to engage with the cheese when you begin your day in such a way that you really understand what it is that you're going to have to sell. How does it look? How does it taste? Is it the right temperature? How are the cheeses tasting compared to how they tasted yesterday? How is that compared to how they were tasting last week and the weeks before? Because I believe that if the cheesemonger has got in their gut
Is that work or tasks?
That's the work. That's the work. The tasks are all the essential, but I would say peripheral things to that. To the most important, part of the cheesemonger's day, which is their work, which is making sure that the priority is taken care of, which is to taste the cheese that day before the customers come through the door to understand what you think tastes good.
Right.
And I think that's often the tasks can get ahead of the work. So in other words, you think, well, I've got so much to do today that sometimes the business of understanding what it is that you have to sell is not necessarily ever arrived at.
I agree with that.
And I think that's the priorities need to be organized such that the cheesemonger understands that in order to be successful in his or her work, that that is made the utmost priority is to understand how the cheese tastes.
So your work is to sell the cheese in the right condition.
Your work is to understand how the cheese is. So let's just drill down into how it looks on our cheese counter, because it's the one that I'm the most familiar with.
The Neil's Yard Dairy counter.
Correct. And so if the cheesemonger that's working that day is to be truly successful in their work, then they will take time at the beginning of their shift to taste through some or all of the cheeses that we have to sell. Now, I understand that there are many cheese counters that have an enormous number of cheeses to sell. We are in the fortunate position that we have maybe 60. I wouldn't always taste all 60, because some cheeses I know are the same batches as the ones that I sold yesterday.
But what if you sell all 60 in one day, all 60 types? Do you consider it a failure of the cheesemonger that they haven't gone through? Is one of their tasks to go through? I mean, is it their work to go through and make sure that all 60 are perfect? And are all 60 ever perfect?
No, it's not. It's not about them being perfect.
Saleable.
It's about understanding how they taste.
Or just where they are.
So when I say, know how this cheese that you're tasting today compares to how the cheese was. That same type of cheese, let's just say for the sake of argument, it's Montgomery's cheddar. Uh-huh. How does the one that's in front of you today, batch that you're cutting, compare with the one that you were selling this time last week or the week before? Because for the customer that's coming in may have come in and last bought the cheese 2 weeks before. Chances are, in our shop, because we sell that particular cheese very quickly, it's a guarantee that the cheese, the batch that they will buy this time and taste...
Okay.
Will not be the same batch. Therefore, it will not taste the same. It will have a slightly different profile. It won't be wildly different.
But it'll be a little different.
But it might be... Maybe it's not quite as interesting, or maybe it's got a different character to the cheese that...
But they need to know that.
They have to know that. They have to... they don't have to know what it was like compared to the last time. They just need to know in their head where that ranks in the other cheeses that they've got to sell today.
Sure.
And where does that Montgomery's cheddar rank in the context of the other cheddars that we have to sell today? And there might be other cheesemongers with different opinions. It's not.
But what are the tasks, I'm sorry to interrupt you for a second, what are the tasks that stop them from doing that most important work? What are the tasks of the cheesemonger?
So,
you said that there's work, but that's the important,
correct,
the important stuff.
Correct.
But there are tasks that get in the way.
Yeah.
What gets in the way?
Well, it doesn't get in the way, it just needs to be done. The other things that need to be done will be, practical things. A lot of cleaning.
Right.
You know, to run an effective cheese shop, there's an awful lot of cleaning that needs to be done.
Simple retail stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are some mongers who, maybe are not, some managers have got more of those tasks to do than some mongers.
Yeah.
But I guess the point is that if the culture is not one where it's recognised that it's very important to understand how that cheese that's in front of you today tastes.
Right.
Then you will be a less effective cheese
monger. If your sanitizer is right on, if it's right in the right spot, shit, you're doing great.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
But other examples of tasks, temperature recording, scraping of cheese, facing cheeses, there is a lot of all of this to do. And it's important that it's done.
Yeah.
But in order to be an effective cheesemonger, if you do not understand how the cheese in front of you tastes fully, and you know where it's come from, you may know some anecdotes or stories about where it's come from, and that might help you to sell the cheese. But ultimately, how that cheese tastes today, and whether your customer likes that or not, is something that you need to be on top of.
And I couldn't agree with you more. One of the most important parts of the job is sampling the cheese to the customer, so that they can understand the flavor. What's the most effective way to do that?
So sampling, we've been visiting a number of cheese shops over the course of the last week. And it's amazing how different the cheeses are in terms of how they're kept, the temperatures they're kept at. Some are really embalmed in Saran, some are less embalmed in Saran. The way that you sample that cheese, whether you sample it on a knife, whether you sample it on a cheese plane,
whether you put a pile of it out there,
if you want to feed the Gray's Brigade,
they're there,
which is not a strategy that I embrace.
Me neither.
If you use a cheese plane, you have a very fine shaving.
Yeah.
And certain cheeses don't like that. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of the cheese plate.
I think all the cheese plates in the world should be gathered and melted down into one giant cheese plate.
Yeah.
And then that cheese plate should be taken out into the ocean and thrown into the fucking middle of the ocean.
I don't feel quite as strongly as you, but I'm not far behind. You know, and then, and where, and how does that cheese, bit of cheese taste? Has it come from just under the plastic?
Yeah.
You know, again,
second layer tastings are good.
Yeah. Part of the culture that we have, which I think is a solid one, but not always possible in everyone's environment, is to have a taste of the cheese at the same time as you're tasting it with the customer. So it does mean frequently in our business that we're tasting, retasting the same cheese.
I do that a lot.
Multiple times.
I encourage that as well.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way for them to but I think what unfortunately happens is you have shopkeepers or owners or managers. A lot of times I think what happens in the United States, but it's happening less, but what I've seen happen is that, you know, the managers and the customers are a mindset of like, holy fuck, I just saw this guy like stick a piece of cheese in his mouth, like, you know, at the same time he's like eating while he's waiting on someone. And that is a culture that exists in a lot of grocery stores here, especially, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those same managers and customers are totally okay with that person wearing a pair of gloves and making them a sandwich and then handling dirty money
and
like wiping the back of their head because the gloves are on.
Yeah.
So we do that as well. But here in America, and I think everywhere, the story is part of it. And I want to know your opinion, like how the lore and the story, because cheesemongery has a lot of lore these days, I feel like. There's a lot, there's always been stories and lore that I personally enjoyed and maybe that hooked me in the beginning. But how effective of a tool is that, selling cheese, for you and your people and your mind?
I think it can be useful. I think that if the story or the lore comes ahead of understanding how the cheese tastes today, and often that can be the case, then I think that's not particularly instructive for the customer, because you know they might want to, you know, it might be interesting for them to know that, you know, old Mrs. Scruttox made this, you know, made this Lancashire cheese with, you know, with the milk from one cow, you know, on a windswept hill somewhere in northwest of England, and it all sounds very romantic.
Well, when you say it, it does.
But ultimately, how does it taste?
Right.
So I think that there is a place for animating, and you know, and creating a little bit of interest and theatre around the cheese.
I think so too.
But not if you're going to use it just as the only hook that you have to sell the cheese. And the problem also with that phenomenon is that these stories often get handed down from one monger to the next, or one generation of mongers to the next. And it, you know, rather like a Chinese whisper. What was old Mrs. Scruttox?
Yeah.
You know, goat's milk logs was old Mrs. Buttocks. Or, you know, goat's milk
Mrs.
logs.
Buttocks.
Because that's what can happen.
So it's a game of telephone.
Because then it
misinformation gets there, then it
becomes bullshit. I think that's my problem with it. So long, if it's managed, that's great. But if the cheesemonger is kind of depending on a story to sell the cheese, then that's what I'm wary of. So I'm not against it. I just want to make sure that that there's a verification going on about what's being communicated.
But there's a different the culture in for myself. I was lucky when I started to become a cheesemonger. There were few of us, you know. So I had to like the cheese when I got a visit from a person like you, who brought a lovely cheese maker along with them, you know, I was eating the cheese. The cheese maker at that time was usually, you know, our plants were to go out and get loaded afterwards. And I heard a lot of stories, and I used a lot of those stories to sell a lot of cheese.
Absolutely.
And it got me in the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it also helped me to differentiate between cheeses for a lot of customers. And be like, so what is that? What is that? Jim's cheese? We're like, well, Jim's a crazy fucker. I mean, and I met him last week. You know, but that game of telephone happens here more because I think what happens here is the idea of you buy, the idea that you buy cheese here, or, and I think it happens less, or it's something that you and I have discussed, and I like to change, is that people buy cheese for different reasons here, or they did in my youth, you know what I mean? When they came into Dean DeLuca to buy some cheese, they were buying a story to tell their friends. They weren't buying a big piece of Cheshire that was going to sustain them for any period of time.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, and you would agree with me, that a company like the Neal's Yard Dairy, you really want to push the importance of cheese. And I know you, your agenda personally, of sustenance versus maybe like a boutique-y experience. Right?
I sort of refer to it as, you know, a sustenance over satiation. You know, I like cheeses that, that's just my personal bent, but I do like cheeses that are, cheeses that I can eat a lot of. That you know, people forget that cheese is, it's a food. It's not, as you say, you refer to a lot of cheeses these days are sort of, you know, boutique.
It's weird. Like, they are. It's just, I mean, I think that price has a lot to do with that. But I think the way people eat, the way they grow up eating and what they're taught makes it different. And cheesemongery in a place where you are, they say rural or semi-rural, where I'm from, I didn't even have a cheese shop, I used to go to one farm and put some money in a fucking coffee can, and take cheese out of a refrigerator. I don't know if that was sustaining us, but I know I like to have it around the house. Cheesemongery for me, when it became a cheesemonger for me, and even in Boston, I probably had 30, 40 cheeses, was that experience. It was... Yeah. These needed to be dainty and have a very certain nature for me to purchase them from you.
Yeah.
I feel like the Neal's Yard Dairy, when I've been in there and that vibe in that shop, is like, we've got big cheeses, big piles of cheese. We want you to buy big slabs of cheese, and we want you to eat them as opposed to, like, banter about them.
I think one of the key points, you're familiar with the cheeses that you have to sell that day by tasting them, or whether you need to use a story, or you have a story to tell about the cheeses, or a bit of both. What I think is important to understand about either of those is that it enables the cheesemonger to be more confident about the cheese they have to sell today.
Right.
So I refer to that as selling on the front foot. So if you have a cheesemonger that understands what he or she have got to sell today and feel good about it, feel positive about it, then that will create an energy that's positive that the consumer, the customer, will feed off.
And is that what the number one trust builder between you and your customers are at that shop? That's the number one way you get them to trust you, right?
In? They trust us if we lead them to something that we're receptive to what they have to say. We're listening to what they have to say in terms of what they're asking for, and then we supply them with tastes of cheese that lead them to the cheese that they leave with. So that I remember when I first visited the shop in the very early days before even working there, I would know that I had been led to arrive at a selection of cheeses that were in my bag, and I was so excited about what I'd bought because I was so confident that I'd got cheeses that I knew were really good and really I was going to be really happy about eating later on. But I would be into that bag on the tube before I even got home.
Sure.
So excited was I.
That's great.
But I think that one of the reasons this makes you an effective cheesemonger is that whether it's understanding that cheese and getting that right cheese to the right customer, or whether it's also embellishing that with a bit of information, which a bit of theatre, which makes that an even more entertaining experience for the customer. Both of those are good things. The first one, I think, really is the work. I think the storytelling helps the work,
but the work has to be there.
But I think that the work is actually tasting and understanding cheese is today. And the work is also listening to the customer and understanding from them after that first taste, they seem to react in a way that suggested to me that was a bit strong. So the next cheese that I'm going to taste them on is going to be maybe a couple of notches down in terms of personality and strength.
Certainly.
That's the work. But I think if the cheesemonger has got has got that confidence that they really know how the cheese on their cheese counter tastes today, they will sell it on the front foot. They will step forward into the interaction. They'll step forward into the conversation, confident that they know how that cheese tastes, confident they know that that cheese better than their customer, and that they are in a position to lead their customer to the right cheese. If they don't have that confidence, and sometimes they don't have that confidence because they're new to the work, and sometimes they might not have that confidence because they actually haven't tasted the cheese, the customer is going to feed off that.
Yeah, and they'll know.
The customer, like an animal, will sense
that fear. And that's the way I do it, too. Yeah. It's like, I'm in charge here.
Yeah.
I like to tell people what to buy. But it's often because I've eaten so much before they've already come here. It's like that I know the selection.
But I have to pull you up on something you just said.
Yeah.
So you said, I like to tell people what they like, what they should buy. Now, but the thing about that is that it's very good to know how you think, what you think they should buy and what you think tastes best.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because recently I had a conversation with the founder of our organization about this very subject of selling from the front foot. And he came back to me and said, because he's always likes to fight the opposite argument.
Contrarian?
That's maybe too strong. Devil's advocate is
sure,
more
sure.
like it. And so he said, we always actually sold from the back foot. Which had me on the back foot. And yes and no, because it's true that he was in agreement that it was our job to find what we thought was the best cheese and give it to the customer to taste.
Right.
But actually, so that's the reaching out over the counter and communicating to the customer with a taste of cheese. But actually, he said, it was our work to listen and check with the customer that what they were tasting was actually what they wanted. So
is true.
And so you need to check. So you think you have a really good cheese, but then you need to check that actually that it is a good cheese, because sometimes either what you think is not as good as you thought it was.
Right.
Maybe this was a not quite as good a batch of Montgomery's as the batch the customer bought 3 weeks ago. Or maybe they just want something completely different.
Well, I think
not to be so confident that you're going to sell a customer.
You don't want to bully them into buying something
exactly.
that they don't want.
Exactly.
I like to nudge them into what I think they should buy, only because I have tasted a lot. And I'm guilty too. I'd ask you one quick question. We've got to take a break.
Yeah.
And we're
going
to move on to another section. Yeah. Now. What would you say, just off the cuff, percentage of locals to tourists in your shop in London?
Yeah.
What would you say percentage is?
In one shop, the shop which has the higher percentage of tourists would be Covent Garden, probably about 15% of tourists.
Wow. So you got 60?
Most of them are American.
65% locals at that shop.
No. It's 15%.
Locals.
15% tourists.
Yeah.
85%
locals.
I was just
been
questioning
a long
your
day.
Mess. Sorry.
Yeah, well, you should, because it sucked. So hang out with us for a second. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk to Jason a little bit more about curating his selection of cheese at the Essex Cheese Company. Hold on.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hello and welcome back to Cutting the Curd in the Heritage Radio Network. We're here with cheese legend Jason Hines, who was talking to us about being an effective cheesemonger, and a conversation I love to have with Jason always. Wanted to take a step back from that, but not totally back from that, and talk about curating a cheese selection in a shorter segment we're going to run here. On our first episode together, we talked about Essex Street Cheese Company, of which I was the first employee, and I'm very proud of that. Congrats on your 10-year anniversary, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm really glad I didn't ruin the company. To our listeners, definitely look into episode number 181 if you haven't. To that effect, there was a beauty to the simplicity of selling one cheese, Comté, and knowing that cheese well, understanding how the flavor varied, and selling the very best examples of that one cheese. But it goes against, you know, the more prominent philosophy to diversify your offerings so that you capture a larger market, and you had to do that. We could not exist in the Essex market on one cheese alone.
One cheese alone, that's right.
Although I think it would have been the coolest thing in the history of time if we could have.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to tell me, because you grew your selection on a wholesale level. We're not going to go there.
Yeah.
You added some other cheeses, Parmigiano, Manchego, some Gouda, from fantastic people, some of the best of the best. And I love all those folks and their cheese, and I carry it here.
Yeah.
But I wanted you to tell me more about your philosophy on composing the ideal cheese selection, curating it for a retail counter.
Yeah.
Based on what you had to do kind of for the growth you made at Essex.
Yeah. Well, I think that, curating a selection is first of all, you know, governed by making sure that you have the categories well represented for, we're talking about a retail counter here.
Yeah.
And so, and very often, and certainly when I visit lots of cheese shops that we sell to, and I look at the range of cheese that they have in their counters, but the same trends apply irrespective of what country you're in, generally.
Yeah, sure.
And so what you tend to see is that certain categories are way overloaded and others are appropriately loaded. The exercise really is to on a piece of paper just put the heading of all the categories. So you've got, you know, cow's milk mold ripened, cow's milk washed rind, cheddar. In the British selection, you'd have territorial, blue cow's milk, and so on. You'll probably find there's 10, 11, 12, 13 headings, categories.
Certainly.
And then below that, you put the types. And in my experience, there was just not too long ago, I was working very closely with a company that we sell cheese to in London, quite a well-known food hall called Selfridges.
Yeah.
Good customer of ours. And they, we made the decision to reduce the selection in their counter from 144. I wanted to cut it in half.
Right.
They felt it was a bit too draconian. And in the end, we went down from about 144 to about 80. Because I felt very clearly that mongers were spending so much time scraping cheese.
Yeah.
And so much time looking down. You know, they have rules and regulations in larger companies like that, where shelf used by dates and such are basically a part of the working life. Because the cheeses were spending too much time in the case and not turning quickly enough, the cheesemongers were spending, I noticed, most of the time looking into the counter at what needed to be either moved on, reduced, scraped, or...
And that's brutal.
And the problem with that is that the cheese quality was diminishing all the time because the cheese was not being sold. Its quality was diminishing. And not only that, it seemed to me that people were spending all their time with their heads in the counter, not looking out of the counter at customers to attend to what they needed.
Right.
And so the theory was, and we put it into action, and it did actually pay off, was that if we were to have Obviously, the number of categories remains the same and they were covered. We still had good representation in each of those categories.
Right.
But the number were reduced in some cases dramatically, and the category that was always was generally overloaded was the mulled ripe and cow's milk category.
Why do you think that is?
I think people just, you know, I think it's...
Do things get overloaded like that?
Because people, you know, people often respond to the demands of their customers, or they get excited about something new.
It has to be new.
It's a malady.
Yeah, it is. It's a malady, tough.
And it's all. I'm all for bringing new things in.
Yeah.
But I do think if a new thing comes in, another thing should go out.
Right.
But that tends not to be the case. It tends, you know, cheese curating a cheese selection tends not to be a revolving door.
No, it's a balloon.
Yeah, it is exactly a balloon. And I think that if it's not attended to, if you don't move cheeses out at the same rate that you bring new ones in, the reality is, unless you have stupendously increasingly fast-growing sales, to accommodate this increasing range that you're putting into
that
your counter.
That comes with its own problem, I can tell you that for a fact. But I understand what you mean.
Yeah. So I think the inevitable consequence or outcome is that the cheese quality is going to go down, and then you're not serving the needs of your customers.
I agree. So have what you need and not necessarily what you want.
Correct.
That's what I think you're saying, and I believe in it. Although I am a spendthrift as a purchaser, I do want new things, but I don't want them for the sake of being new.
Yeah.
What happens in America a lot is people want things that are local, you know what I mean? And they want things that are local, but they also want things that no one else has.
Yeah.
You know, and we have this thing here where it has to be local, has to be where no one else has. I don't think you and your cheese shop have the opportunity to just start picking up local cheeses unless they're like being made in the tube, like down, you know, like below the shop, right? I mean, you're traveling thousands of miles to get your cheese, right?
Yeah.
So you can manage that 60 cheeses, say, in the Neil's Yard Dairy, and they become classics.
Yeah.
You know, I think that what happens in America is it becomes like, you know, and you're still selling Parmigiano? It's like, of course I'm fucking still selling Parmigiano. What's wrong with you, man, right? You know, and I think that also speaks to the difference. What I thought was really interesting that you mentioned before was work versus tasks. Because if work is to sell the cheese and to taste the cheese, but a task is to clean the cheese, and you're just inundated with all of these tasks, you know, you're always doing that, and you're not mongering cheese.
Or in the case that I gave before, a task would be go through your counter, look at the use-by dates, you know, or temperatures. All these kinds of tasks are all there to be done.
We have to do that. Use-by dates on cheese, and that's a whole other show that I would love to do with you, and probably lose my job, and no one ever will let. But are brutal. I mean, they're very brutal and they're very misleading. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you have to kind of mess with them, but they're a necessary evil in our world.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I agree.
But all of that's true. You know, I mean, is it a big? Do you find that the cheesemongers, because you? The quality of cheesemonger you put out at the Neil's Yard Dairy, do you find that because the selection is so focused that they're more focused?
I don't think that. First of all, they're focused because they're able to, you know, as we said at the top of the show, they're able to taste and retaste on a regular basis all the cheeses they have to sell and get around that selection. If I had to taste 250 cheeses every morning, I'd soon lose the appetite to become a cheesemonger.
Right.
But not only that. The cheeses, we look forward to tasting those cheeses because we also know that generally they're turning at such a lick that the quality of them is actually very good.
Right.
Not always. Definitely not always. We're not perfect.
There's no perfect.
But the cheese is selling fast enough because we haven't overloaded.
Right.
When we've curated the selection, we haven't overloaded that selection.
Yeah.
And therefore, by and large, the cheese is turning at a rate where. What we're doing is we put the cheese on the counter. We think it's a good cheese. By tasting it in the morning, not only are we understanding how the cheese tastes, but we're also confirming for ourselves that the quality of the cheese is where we want.
Right.
Actually, has this cheese been kicking around the shop for 3 or 4 days?
Right.
Cut.
Yeah.
And would have benefited from being sold more quickly. Ask the question. actually, is this cheese? Should we rest this cheese for a little bit?
Right.
You know, is it the summer and perhaps this is the right time to be sent? Should we just take it out
just
of the
get it out?
Get it out. Take it out of the lineup for a little bit. Maybe reintroduce it later on.
Yeah.
So then, when you do bring it back later on, it is almost like introducing a new cheese. It isn't because it's always part of your lineup. But be thinking more strategically about working with the lineup that you've got rather than simply always adding something.
And I think when you talk about seasonality, I feel like we get obsessed with the seasonality of the cheese, but we forget about the seasons that are around us and that the climate of our shop changes in the summer, you know, and that we may have to shrink the selection, you know. And I think all of that goes into the art of mongery, you know, to explain to people, like, no, we just don't have that in August. It's 102 degrees, so, you know, and Fahrenheit out there.
And also to go back to, you know, the storytelling that we talked about at the top of the show, when you mentioned seasonality, that's a really easy, as you did just now.
I feel like it's a trap.
It's a very easy thing to hang your hat on. A lot of people are very, very preoccupied with seasonality. It's not so relevant with British cheese because it rains all the time and there's not much variation between the summer and the winter.
Right.
So it's not so relevant for us anyway. But actually, you can have a greater variation. I mean, I guess the point about seasonality is the variation that it causes in the cheese that's available to sell. So, you know, of course, if you buy, you buy a Conte that's made in the summer versus the winter, it'll be a different colour. And, you know, it maybe won't be quite as complex. That's, you know, generally the case. But the difference, you know, between one and the other might not be enormous in terms of quality. You can have much greater variation, in the cheese from one cheese shop to the next, according to how you handle it, how you give the taste. You know, if I give a little sliver of Cheshire to a customer, a piece of Cheshire that's stone cold, or I give a piece of Cheshire that's a chunk, which is much easier to taste, it's at the right temperature. That seasonality, if you like, from one type of cheese and the other, that variation between one, the flaky cold piece and the chunky, appropriately, cheese at the appropriate temperature, is a much more relevant variation as far as the cheesemonger and the
consumer.
Then what exactly?
Yeah, came out of the end.
Correct. And I think that's something that, that's in the control of the cheesemonger to be able to make sure that the cheese is sold at the right, you know, is tasted at the right temperature.
But let me, do you feel at all responsible because you must go into shops that have Cheshire that are sold that way.
Yeah.
Do you feel at all responsible for that? You know what I mean? You sell them the cheese. Do you explain to them?
I think it's absolutely our responsibility to point out to a shopkeeper that is perhaps not doing themselves a favor by serving the cheese. It might be that they serve one particular cheese using a plain, but actually to use a plain on a Cheshire is not doing that. You're not doing the Cheshire, any favors, or the sales of the Cheshire any favors, because it doesn't taste properly.
Right.
Doesn't taste as it should.
Right.
And so if we were to not raise that with the cheesemonger, then we're not giving them the tools to do a better job selling that particular cheese. So it's absolutely essential that we point that out. And when we do, it's always well received.
I like that. I think that's the next level. I think that what I've seen in cheesemongery is really interesting. I love stories. I mean, I sit here and talk to you. Mm. I do this. I love to talk and I love to tell stories and to hear them. Mm. And they're very much a part of why I loved cheese and why I still do. Mm. But the aspects of being a cheesemonger were something I respected from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Because I knew there was no support around me. If I didn't learn how to handle the product, I no longer was paid.
Yeah, yeah.
So I needed that.
Yeah.
So, but when I look at my world around me now, I see a lot of mongers. I see different sects. It's like a religious sects of mongery that go on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have the zealots. You got the people who only go to church on Christmas cheesemongers.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
All of that. You've got all of those people. So maybe our next evolution is to teach us what to buy, not as the cheesemonger, but as the curator. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Could you picture like another cheesemonger invitational, but shop curating. You know what I mean?
Absolutely right.
Like, you know, like you get those guys together. It's like, all right, now we taught you how to taste and touch and feel. Mm-hmm. Now we teach you how to build the whole goddamn thing.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
You think we can get there?
100%.
Yeah, me too. And hopefully I'll be right there with you, you know, complaining the entire way. I wanted to just to be play devil's advocate just a little bit, ask you one last question before we go, because I get so little time with you, and I like to talk to you, Jay. So sometimes being a visionary means being economically unsuccessful for a while before the market appreciates the value proposition of a visionary company. Cheese companies especially go through this, I feel like. What advice do you have to folks who are staying true to their vision, even when the market around them is telling them they should stock bad commodity cheese?
Well, I think it's easy to stock bad commodity cheese. I think equally, you know, the other thing that's difficult for people that are starting out is that they don't have a high, there's not a lot of people know about, not a lot of people visit them, and they have competition. And I think that you have to stick to your principles. You have to, you know, you have to stick to, you know, the basics of good quality cheese and good quality service. I know that's such a you know, an obvious thing to say.
Yeah, but it's not done all the time.
And it's a very difficult thing to, you know, to stick to, particularly in the early days when you're you know there's only, you know, three customers come in on a Monday afternoon, but ultimately if the cheese is really good, they will come. And this is, you know, we've seen this in 37 years of Neil's Yard Dairy.
Yeah,
we've always, you know, currently we have it's not a third shop, it's kind of an outlet which is near where we mature the cheese, in East London. It's only open on a Saturday. It's behind a pretty big project, tucked between a project and a railway line in sort of tumbleweed alley in a horrible old 1950s industrial estate.
Yeah.
There's one or two other small businesses around us, but it's an incredibly busy 5 hours that we're open. Why do people come? Because the food and the food that's available and the cheese that's available in that little shop, which is an even more finely curated range than the range that we have in our own shops. It's only about 20 cheeses that they sell. It draws them to Tumbleweed Alley.
Yeah.
And you have to stick to the principles of, you know, this is the best cheese that we can get our hands on.
Yeah.
And we're going to really focus on how we interact with our customers when we sell that cheese to them, and they will come. And believe me, if you were to see where these people come from when they come to buy the cheese from us on a Saturday afternoon in East London, it gives you faith that stick to those guns and the people will buy the cheese.
That's amazing. That's the best. I try to do that every day here, and it's not hard because I work for great people, but there's always that, you know, it's always easy to cheap out, man. It's
absolutely.
So easy, but fuck that.
Don't do it.
Nah, not going to do it. So I want to thank you so much for your time, and it's so great to see you. I want to give a quick shout out to CMI winner Najib Showoff. What
Absolutely.
A fucking awesome guy.
Awesome.
Congratulations to you. What a badass job.
I think he gets he's going to come to us for a week to work.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I talked to him after that, and I thought he was sick. And I've had him on the show before. I was lucky enough to be a judge in the CMI this year. It was like really, really amazing to be a part of that. You know, I'd understood it in a way that I never did before. Rock on to you, Najib. And come and listen to us next week for more Cutting the Curd. Thanks, Jason. Ciao.
Until next year.
Yeah, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves? Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.